Your child has so much potential, but your local schools may not be right for them. Check out K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited tuition-free online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
This weekend only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.
Moving on here to Bill Greer real quick. We got a lot of stuff here to cover, so I'm just going to hit you with questions.
Sure.
Everything out. Why do you think the driver, Bill Greer, didn't hit the gas when he heard the first shot, or after Kellerman told him to get out of line? He looks back, then he looks back again. I mean, the thing that's hard about this is you could always say, yeah, he just panicked. Like, he didn't have any poise. And when it came time to be clutch, he wasn't clutch. He just crumbled under pressure. And I think a lot of people would probably look at themselves and go, you know, I'd probably do that. So I think
a lot of people would do that, but not trained right. Secret Service agents had the experience right. of driving presidents from Truman on. Now, he was associated with FDR on his yacht, but he was driving presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy many times. He had proper training. He knew what to do. Yes, he went to Secret Service school. So he has the training and common sense, and he also has the order in his ear from his superior, Roy Kellerman. Roy Kellerman famously told William Manchester, Bill Greer then looked in the back of the car. Maybe he didn't believe me. Believe it or not, Matt, it wasn't until 1991 that most people didn't realize that Bill Greer looked back twice. I went to a conference as a young lad of 25, 1991. Bob Cutler, Harry Livingston, George Mike Weave, all these people were there. In fact, Robert Groden famously said, I guess that's why they call the Secret Service secret, Vince. I never really paid attention to them or cared, to be honest with you. Well, these people are looking at the Zapruder film for the million times. And Vince, I never noticed that. Bill Greer's looking around for a second time. It's like, yeah, because I have a vested interest. So when the first shot or shot rings out, okay? Greer looks around. He's looking right at Kennedy, which he denied ever doing. Roy Kellerman saying, get out of line, we've been hit. Greer disobeys that order, turns around a second time. Remember when Kellerman said, you know, he looked back in the car, but he didn't believe me. Staring at Kennedy until the fatal headshot makes his mark, turns back forward, hits the gas, and only then denies all this to the Warren Commission. So it's a matter of, yes, we can make the claim. I understand a little bit of the validity of that. There's a part of your brain that says, oh, Vince, you know, you really think he would really want to put himself in the line of fire? I understand all that, but actions speak louder than words, and it is what it is, that even people like Posner and Bugliosi have said the success of this assassination is down to Greer. They believe Oswald acted alone, but the point is they believe if he didn't slow down the car, Kennedy lives. So you have that. Then you also have two other major elements. I'm sure if you read my first book, you have saw. Bill Greer died in 1985. Spoke to his son in 1990 and 1991. And it was a nice conversation, but it got really awkward when I asked him what his father thought of President Kennedy. He avoided me. It'd be like, Matt, if you asked me a question, I just sat here like this. Like, Vince, can you hear me? Should I repeat it? Well, I stumbled and I got back on other things. And so I got back around. I said, sir, so what did your father think of President Kennedy? And you'd think he would have said something like, oh, he loved him. President Kennedy loved him. He said, well, we're Methodists and JFK was Catholic. That statement looms large when years later, 2013 to be exact, the Irish Times contacted me, not me contacted them. They contacted me and said, you know, we got some information. I'm sure you'll be very interested in. Bill Greer and his family are part of the Order of the Orange. And if anybody knows about the battles, you know, bloody wars in Ireland for years, the Protestants, the Catholics, Methodists too, got all that. And again, a stranger on the phone, he should have lied and just said, yeah, oh, my father loved President Kennedy. He ignored it the first time. He comes around and said, we're Methodists and JFK Catholic. Bill Greer came to this country at the age of 18, emigrated from Ireland through Canada and came here. Okay, he was in Boston. He drove Henry Cabot Lodge, who later was, you know, the ambassador to Vietnam, who was a political opponent of JFK's twice, you know, also when he ran as Vice President Nixon's running mate. He was in Boston. Bill Greer had to know all the stuff about Joe Kennedy Sr., all the bootlegging allegations, had to know a lot of the dirt on the Kennedys, whether it was true or not. He had that. So he had grist for the mill there. And again, when you factor in his lack of action and you factor in what his son said about him, and then before you can catch your breath on that, I find out, this is only in the late 1990s I found this out, one of the main drivers of President Kennedy, along with Greer and one other one, Morgan Geis, Thomas Shipman, died of an alleged heart attack October 14th, 1963 in Camp David. He's the first person to die at Camp David. He's the first Secret Service agent to die at Camp David. The only Kennedy detail agent who died in line of duty 61 to 63 is this Thomas B. Shipman. I only find this out by happenstance, make it very brief. There's a book that came out. It came out in 1982. The guy who wrote it died in 1970. It was George McNally. His widow came out with it in 1982. It was strictly like a Kinko's FedEx type of deal where she cut and paste and, you know, put it together with staples and whatnot. Andy Rawlast, Raw Bookshop had it, and some other people know about it. Well, anyway, George McNally is a former Secret Service agent who became head of WICA, the White House Communication Agency. He was on all the motorcades for Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, I think even into Nixon. So he was there for all of this. His book's unindexed. I'm reading it, and it's good, a little boring, but kind of good for somebody like me, like Secret Service. And out of nowhere, he goes, Thomas Shipman, one of President Kennedy's drivers, died suddenly. This is a few pages before he talks about the Texas drum, like, and the chronology of events. Wow, this is shortly before. I look at all my books, and I've never heard of this guy. Everyone else I'm talking to, they never heard of Thomas Shipman, a Secret Service agent. It took years to get this out. And it turned out, yes, he was one, again, thanks to ARB releasing the Secret Service shift reports and talking to other agents and whatnot, it turned out he was one of the agents of the guard, or drove Kennedy and guard too. And there's films and photos, again, only came out, you know, last 5 to 15 year range of him driving Kennedy. In fact, when Patrick Kennedy died in August of 63, he's driving them all over the place. You know, he drove Kennedy and also and Jacqueline Kennedy as well. And I suppose this is really what clinched it for me. There's an old lawyer's adage, I'm sure you've heard this one. Don't ask a question you don't know the answer to, because you might get burned. Like, oh, man. Oh, they're killing me. This, oh, I should never ask this question. Now my case is hurt. Why went in blind with his family? His family could have turned around and said, oh, he had a heart ailment. Oh, Vince, you're barking up the wrong tree. There's nothing suspicious of this. Instead, his family said they were always suspicious of his death. First of all, they didn't seek any money or fame or nothing. They're obscure. They're living in Colorado like they were before. So nothing about any like remuneration or fame or nothing. As a matter of fact, they said they were always suspicious. He passed an annual physical. Age is supposed to be fit and fiddle. Well, he's a driver. If he has a heart attack, something happens to him, there goes the president, all the people in the car, maybe even bystanders as he crashes the limo. Okay, he just passed the annual physical. He was looking forward to go to the Dallas trip in particular because Thomas Shipman had relatives. They have relatives in Dallas. So you said in particular, he couldn't wait to get to Dallas, Texas because he had relatives there. He dies of a heart attack. That gives Bill Greer carte blanche to be the driver because Morgan Geis at that time was mainly the head of the White House garage. He very rarely drove at this point. He was more a driver for Truman and Eisenhower. He's part of the White House garage detail. And Sam Kinney usually drove the FOB car. So by process of elimination, that gave Greer the opportunity to drive Kennedy. And for people who are suspicious of Greer, I don't think Greer had anything to do with shooting the president, that crap. But people like me think he's one of the suspects who slowed down the limo and took hold of Kennedy's clothing. And he, the bottom line, it is what it is. He had these bizarre feelings about Kennedy. He came from the Order of the Orange. He was there and Thomas Shipman wasn't. And for what it's worth, I mean, what are they going to say? I know. But his daughter and his one of his cousins said that, yeah, they think that if Thomas Shipman would have driven Kennedy, Kennedy would have lived. He wouldn't have done what Greer did, you know. But that's speculation, I understand. But the bottom line is the family said, oh, no, they forget the family for a second. What was really bizarre, Matt, was none of the major newspapers, and there was nothing on TV about Thomas Shipman's death. 10 years later, an agent, Cliff Dietrich, dies in a helicopter crash. She's there to protect Nixon. President Nixon had a press conference talking about Cliff Dietrich's bravery. Pat Nixon and one of the daughters, Trish, goes to the funeral. Yeah, JFK, for any faults he has, was very, very nice about tributes. He mentions nothing. Radio silence about Thomas Shipman's death, nothing from Pierre Salinger, nothing from his aides. There's nothing until I pay $100+ to newspapers.com to get these obscure backwater Maryland newspapers that said Thomas Shipman, one of Kennedy's Secret Service agents, only because I looked for it and paid the money. Are they there? Are these newspapers I reprinted in the book. And it's like, why was there radio silence about this agent who drove Kennedy? He's a pretty prominent agent. Wasn't some guarding the men's room door. He's driving Kennedy. He dies of a heart attack at Camp David. It's all hush-tush. It's only because, if I never pursued this in the late 1990s, I think it never would have been an issue, period. Never, Now, what we knew about this, in fact, the weird thing about this, Matt, it wasn't only to a couple years later, the former Agents Association posted a roll call of agents who passed away. Thousands of men and women have come since 1865. There's only like 37 to 39 agents who passed away in line of duty. Again, Thomas Shipman is one of them. And he started to talk about Thomas Shipman. But the really weird thing, Clint Hill wrote four books, never mentioned Thomas Shipman. Jerry Blaine never mentioned Thomas Shipman, except for in the photo section of his book. He just matter-of-factly lists him as one of the agents in the photo, but says nothing about his death. It's very, very bizarre because he's not an obscure agent. So it's grist for the mill who think that, wow, is there something sinister from Thomas Shipman's death? One thing I'm leaving out, a big thing I'm leaving out. He died on a Tuesday. He was buried on a Thursday. And the daughter, Laura Shipman, told me that Dr. Berkeley took care of everything. Well, that could be taken two ways. He took care of everything, did he? He was buried 2 days later. Where's the toxicology report? Sometimes it takes weeks, if not months, for it to come back. Oh, such and such died of a drug overdose. Such and such, there was something sinister. He had arsenic in him. He dies of a heart attack. If somebody's not, there's a country doctor thing. The guy's not stabbed. He's not shot. Hey, he's heart attack. And 2 days later, he's buried and that's it. That's pretty quick. So.
Yeah, no toxicology report, plus the existence of a heart attack gun as demonstrated in the church committee.
Definitely grist for the mill. Yep.
Enough to make you wonder. All right, let's go to rooftops. You've talked about a lot about the rooftops and the general rule. I just want to kind of jump into that for just a second. One thing we didn't talk about yet, Agent Winston Lawson had the job of coordinating rooftop security with local police, which he told the Warren Commission that he normally did, but he said that he didn't remember confirming rooftop security in Dallas. And the local cops in Dallas all say that Lawson said nothing at all to Dallas cops about anything having to do with rooftop security. So my question for you, Vince, is it really true that there was no rooftop security at all in Dallas, or was it just lacking in Dealey Plaza specifically?
There was, officially speaking, there was no rooftop security whatsoever. There's a little footnote out there. Some people will realize that Dallas Sheriff Harry Weatherford supposedly claimed he was on a rooftop at something for sinister purposes. Like, someone interviewed him during the Penn Jones days and said, yeah, I've shot a lot of people. So they're like, whoa, if this is true, this is kind of a bizarre thing to say. Was, you know, it's grist for the mill, people thinking he was an assassin or whatnot. But the official story is no building rooftops were guarded. In fact, Jerry Blaine, not to be confused with Jerry Bain, otherwise it is detailed, Jerry Blaine, an obscure agent who wrote the Kennedy Detail book, he came out with Larry Sabato. He's been on CNN. He's a political advisor and a professor. He's wrote a book called The Kennedy Half Century. And during an interview for the book, I mentioned in a footnote of Larry Sabato's book, and Jerry Blaine answers my criticism. But he says, we didn't have the manpower to guard building rooftops in Dallas. Okay, so a 10-mile motorcade, we're only talking one part of it, downtown Dallas. You didn't have the manpower. 28-mile motorcade, 4 days before, Jerry Blaine's an advance man for the Tampa trip. You had all that manpower then. You're only asking for a small segment in a city of hate that JFK was warned him on. JFK even said, we're heading to nut country now. And supposedly, I believe this part, to Kenny O'Donnell and Jack and Kennedy. He said, last night would have been a hell of a night to assassinate a president. Keep in mind, Marty Underwood went to him and said, we've got all these rumors you're going to be killed the next day. Oh, Marty, you worry about me too much. They have all that. And yet he goes to Dallas, a city he's warned about, and there's no building security. Again, Joe Petro, a Secret Service agent, albeit he's during the Reagan era onward, came out in his book as a Dealey Plaza, an obviously dangerous area. Another agent I spoke to, John Norris, said Dealey Plaza was very obviously a dangerous spot to take a precedent. And the thing about you go through there, not like the dog leg turn and all that slows down. You had the crossfire, you had the buildings, you had the grassy knoll, you had the overpass, you had the fact you would have been restricted with the speed, and then you had the lack of crowd. When you take about the very few people who were there compared to all the people on Main Street, okay, very few people were there. The press wasn't allowed there, although Ike Alkins, the AP, was there, and they didn't even want him there. Okay, we had to rely on Zapruder and some fluky amateurs to be there. That was the perfect place to kill the president because, again, you don't have the flatbed truck, you don't have professional iron ear witnesses, you don't have a gaggle of motorcycles, you don't have the military aid, you don't have the agents on the back of the car who could have been shot too. For years, Clint always said, I should have been there, I should have been on the back of the car. But later on, he joined the post-Vince Palmera course of Jerry Blaine, that Brian Kennedy didn't want us in the back of the car. They realized they had a legacy because it was little old me out in the wilderness before my first book even came out. I was prominent all over the place online. It just saying a little old amateur like me saying it, these men screwed up. Yeah, Matt, real quick, I got to tell you something real quick. Yeah, I sent a 22-page letter to Clint Hill. In fact, it's going to be in my next book coming out in the spring. I'm actually reproducing the entire 22-page letter because people are going, Vince, what's this letter you sent to Clint Hill? You're always mentioning, well, you'll see it. It's a Cliff Notes version of my first book that at the time wasn't released. And Clint Hill, this is the summer of 2005, admitted on C-SPAN, he burned all his notes in 2005. Jerry Blaine admitted he started writing his book in 2005. Might say to yourself, oh, Vince, there's two different agents. Turned out they were the best of friends since the late 50s, serving in the Denver office. Jerry Blaine even admitted that when he saw some of the outright deceit and whatnot on the internet, I knew I had to write a book. His lawyer contacted me about my blog, asked me to take certain things down. His co-author, Lisa McCubbin, gave my book before it even came out a 1-star. She didn't even see it yet. Other things I won't get into. Well, let's just put it this way. They were very, very much aware of me to the point where not once but twice they mentioned me on C-SPAN. One time they showed a YouTube video of me. You might have saw that. The point being is these guys were fly fishing in Colorado, long retired. In fact, Clint used to wear it as a badge of honor. I'm not talking to any authors. I'm not writing books. I know where they're writing books. And he's marrying his co-author. Could have been his daughter. I mean, change the subject on that. But the bottom line is they're doing all that. It's not delusions of grandeur either. It's little old me because I was calling them out. And they were basically, the thrust of their books are Oswald acted alone and Kennedy helped them. Kennedy didn't want us to protect them. So it got the ball. And the sad thing is, Matt, people that aren't researchers don't study this. You should see the Amazon reviews. They make you want to cry. They believe it. They say, yeah, Kennedy didn't want them there. He had a rendezvous with death. It just infuriates me because Jerry Blaine, when I spoke to him in 2004 and 2005, he joined the course of all the other agents I spoke to. He said, oh, President Kennedy never interfered with us. He's a very nice man. Never got involved in stuff. And then he saw what I was writing. All of a sudden, he came up with a fictitious meeting on November 25th where they all spoke about, we all know President Kennedy orders on the car, but we don't want to blame him. Yet it's in his book for the world to read, a best-selling New York Times bestseller. Now the whole world is going to see about this meeting that didn't take place. But anyway.
Yeah. On the conversation about rooftops.
Yeah.
That is, to me, I just couldn't get my head around. So the official story is that Agent Lawson uniquely forgot to coordinate rooftop security in Dallas, and that's it. There's no counterpart.
That's it.
He forgot.
Matt, you're spot on, man. You I like the way you think. You know what it is? Because he's a Secret Service agent. Because at that time, he's a poor old man being interviewed by local Virginia. In the meantime, his son is a broadcaster. There's a newsman who actually interviewed him in one of the interviews in like 2013 or so. And what it did is creates a situation of these poor, sad old men. Oh, they didn't mean this stuff to happen. It's just fate. Sometimes even Kennedy didn't want things to be done. And because they're the good guys, it's always this thing. Again, I'm not saying all these guys are bad guys. And most of these are good guys. It's like just a few bad apples spoil the bunch. And what it is people for years just didn't look at the Secret Service. They just didn't. Hoover is like a sexy villain. The CIA is a sexy villain. The Mafia, anti-Castro Cubans, and that's a lot of good, valid work on there. I don't want to say, oh, my theory was better than yours. It could be, can we both live together? Could it be the Secret Service had a few bad apples and you had the CIA was actually involved in the assassination, actually made it happen. And it just took a few agents to make to strip that security. All it takes is action through an action. A couple of seconds, Kennedy's dead. Okay. And then, you know, it happens the way it happens. And that's all it takes. And everybody else is just following orders. It could very well be that Winston Lawson's not sinister at all. He was just following orders. He was hamstrung by Floyd Boring ahead of him. You know, again, Floyd Boring, Bill Greer, and Emory Roberts, my three main suspects. I have a few minor ones, but those are the three out of 36 agents of the White House detail, not including all the field office guys. If they're just following orders, well, that's the reason why the other agents didn't lunge forward. Emory Roberts ordered them off the car. You know, the Love Field, Ribka Lawton thing where, you know, agents, you know, famously being recalled. I can't tell Matt, when I found that video footage, we'll talk about that. Yeah. In 1991, trying to think of his name right now. It was a collector. The Collector's Archives in Canada. The name eludes me right now. But back in the VHS pre-DVD days, a lot of people bought from this guy in Canada. And he claimed to have all the ABC WFAA footage. And it turned out somebody in 1983 stayed up in the middle of the night and filmed all this rebroadcast. Well, they recorded on their VCR. All this stuff that they were shown of that weekend as a tribute to the 20th anniversary of Kennedy assassination. He got bootlegs of it. I paid a couple hundred dollars for the bootlegs in 1991. I'm looking to it. And it's fascinating but boring at the same time, a lot of the footage, because it's like, okay, they're taught in the official history. This and that. And you get to Love Field, one of many gems. There's several other, I should say several gems. And I'm looking, okay, why is this agent? Who is this? Not once, not twice, but three times. Throws his hands up in like disgust. Like he was jogging with the limousine. He's called back. And again, it took years to ferret this out, but it boils down. Emory Roberts rises in his seat. I talk about this in The Men Who Killed Kennedy and Coon Kamala. He rises in his seat and gestures like this. Now, obviously, he can't hear because it's far away. Obviously, he's ordering him not to move and get away from the car because Don Lawton goes three times like this. Not only that, Paul Landis makes room for him in the fob car. He actually gets into the fob car and briefly, if you look at the Love Field footage through the first few blocks of the motorcade, there's no one standing where Paul Landis was because Paul Landis had made room for Don Lawton to jump on the car and Don Lawton didn't budge. Don Lawton died about 2012, I think it was. He, I spoke to him in 1995, and he said his one great regret was, oh, there should have been agents on the back of the car. If only there would have been agents on the back of the car. Sadly, Matt, in 1995, I did not know he was the agent. So if I was kicking myself, God, if I only would have knew he was the agent, I could have pounded it even further. But isn't that interesting? The first thing out of his mouth about regrets was, oh, you always have regrets, remorse. If only they didn't have agents in the back of the car. None of this stuff about Kennedy or us off the car. Well, when he died, a local Iowa newspaper interviewed a female military intelligence friend of his, ironically, got very little play. It was only somebody like me who Googles these names all the time, found this in the 50th anniversary, had no comments in the comment section, like it was ignored. And she said that Don Lawton told her many times, I should have been there. I should have been in the back of the car. He rode in the back of the car in the Chicago trip in March 63, rode in the back of the car in Tampa. That's 28 miles. He's hanging on the car with Chuck Zaboral. Now, the cover story, the other story, the other side says, oh, Vince, he was supposed to be staying at Love Field. Paul Landis came out with his book in 2013, said, no. We had plenty of coverage at Love Field. Him being there, that makes no sense. That I never thought that was a good answer. I always thought that was suspicious that Don Lawton was left behind Love Field. We needed everybody we could get, especially because Powers and O'Donnell were riding in the fob car. We needed every swinging you-know-what to be there in the motorcade. Then you have Don Lawton's visceral reaction, and you have him telling me on the phone about agents being on the back of the car. Then you factor in what he told his military intelligence friend. What I think is there's the official history. There's the official story. And there's the real story. Like, in other words, somebody gets with Vince, the Fly Norman pal, that was written before the assassination. How do you explain yourself? How I can explain that myself, just in my job. There's plenty of things written by the boss that people don't adhere to, or they lie and say they do, and they do other things. They do what they think is best for the situation. Yeah, there might be that official directive, hey, Lawton, you're going to stay behind Love Field. But he could have been like, that's bold. So he was taking steps to ready that, and then Emory Roberts rose up and called him away. Now, the thing they don't have an answer for is Henry Ripka was another agent. And for a while, I confused the two. Because, again, I'm at the mercy of the things that were released. In fact, I called him Henry Ripka and Men Who Killed Kennedy and corrected myself by Tom Coon Kamala. Turns out I was right on both halves. What it boils down to is the famous video that everybody sees of the agent rising, that's Don Lawton. But there's newsreel pictures and still pictures of Henry Ripka. Actually, there's a really good newsreel of them both jogging with the limousine together. Henry Ripka, by his own report in volume 25, it's separate from volume 18, where he just left the reports. He says he jogged the limousine. He doesn't say why. He didn't do it anymore. But I strongly suspect it was Emory Roberts, because Emory Roberts forcefully moved Lawton away. So that's right. My counter. That's all my evidence of counter against this thing about this official story. I just say again, there's what the directives are from higher up, and there's what your common sense, your training tell you. And Paul Landis, he had the perfect opportunity. His book came out 2 years ago to defend the whole thing. And he said, that I always find that strange, that segment of that video. And we had plenty of coverage of Love Field. Why was he? I'd love to hear, like Paul Landis threw in there, I'd love to see Winston Lawson's notes to see. That's very interesting because he believed Oswald acted alone too. They were Paul Landis. He also wrote two reports saying a shot came from the front that he didn't tell his readers about, but that's another story. But yeah, that whole footage to me was like a smoking gun. 1991, when I saw that, I could not replay it over again. My God, I showed that at conferences in the 90s before it was ever a YouTube sensation. Somebody could put a poor copy up years ago. I have much better copies on my YouTube channel. And everyone's visceral reaction is, okay, look at this. What is this? And it's only when the other side had that, aha, I have this duty roster and it shows he should have stayed at Love Field. But then again, his reaction, what he said to me and what he said to this woman, and the fact he rode there before November 18th. Oh, if I got another thing too, George Hickey. Okay. George Hickey is an official driver of the fall-up car and sometimes the president's car. He was in the fall-up car. That's not his official duty. His official duty is to be a driver. He was one of the agents of the fall-up car. Glenn Bennett is a PRS agent, a protective research section agent, supposed to stay behind in Washington, monitor threats. He was part of the fall-up car detail. Again, it was either a manpower pull or something sinister. Glenn Bennett's case, he was a protective research section agent who monitored threats to the president. Now, when I started to ask Winston Lawson, by the way, in 2004, and some of his compadres, they all kind of nervously came out and said, I don't know what he was there for, Vince, or they would defend and say, oh, Vince, he might have been a PRS agent. You're barking up the wrong tree, pal. He was there as an agent. Clint Hill, in his book in 2012, said that Bennett was handling intelligence. So corroborate my whole thing about Glenn Bennett. I think he was there covertly monitoring a threat and threats in progress. Kennedy's killed right before his eyes. And I think they were monitoring threats in progress of the president for the prior trips to Florida and Chicago in November. They knew there was active mortal threats to the president. That's why Glenn Bennett was riding in the fall car. And that was kind of covered up after the fact. So
there are many ways to relax after a long or stressful day. And one of my favorite ways is legal cannabis. Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients so that you can target nearly every mood or health concern that you can think of. I'm talking about Mood.com's incredible line of functional gummies. And you can get 20% off on your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood that you're looking for. So head on over to Mood.com to find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. Don't forget to use promo code JFK when you check out to save 20% off of your first order.
These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
All right. So just on this Emory Roberts calling off Lawton and Ripka, the rationale for Roberts telling the agents to stand down was that Kennedy wanted the crowd to be able to see him. But this issue was never raised in a written report. There's nowhere that it says that before the assassination. And it turns out the only primary source for it was Floyd Boring and Gerald Bain. But the only people who even said that they, you know, had heard it as a primary source was Boring and Bain. But then you spoke to them later and both of them recanted their stories. So
adamantly. Yeah. Jerry Bain, September 27, 1992. That's when everything got changed in his head, Matt. I got to tell people, was September 27, 1992? There wouldn't have been a book. Maybe years ago, there would have been a newspaper article, and I would have long gone off this trail and just probably just went on to other things, to be honest, because I've had nothing original to contribute. It's time to move on. Yeah. Up to that point, again, I begrudgingly believed that Kennedy ordered them off the car and other things. And again, this is the head of the White House detail, not a buck private like Jerry Blaine. Jerry Bain, B-E-H-N, was the head of the White House detail. It was in the service from FDR to LBJ. Had Kennedy's ear, and LBJ's ear as well, for that matter. And he's telling me, I don't remember Kennedy ever say anything about not having agents on the back of the car. If you look at the newsreels, you'll see agents on there. That was another cotton-mouth moment where I just could not believe. But again, thinking like a defense attorney, I guess I'm a first-year attorney, I said, okay, Vince, this is really tantalizing, but as the days wore on, I said, you know, someone's going to say, even though he was very lucid, he was 76 and totally of mind, recalled names and things, and he was very spot on. So we could say, some old man out in the wilderness, Vince, where's the corroboration? The corroboration came from Floyd Boring and all their compadres. It's like they were reading a cue card. They were a different part. This is before the internet, so they couldn't Google me and say, oh, this is Vince Palmieri. He's a muckraker. What's he trying to do? As a, some young 25-year-old on the phone, 25, 26-year-old, and they're all telling me the same thing. The underlying thing was President Kennedy was a very nice man. Never interfered with us, never ordered us off the car, never ordered the top off, never ordered the motorcycles away. I don't know what you're talking about. This is total bunk. But some of these agents were also coming back and said, Oswald acted alone. I'm convinced Oswald acted alone. So everything's compartmentalized. They're retired now. They're getting their pensions. It's all over. There's some young guy on the phone. The truth comes out in situations like that because you're not before Congress. You're not sitting here being prepped by Secret Service attorneys like some of them were during the House Select Committee days. You're just answering truthfully. Yeah, President Kennedy never. But back in 1964 during the Warren Commission, I think there was a directive to get a few agents to put on the record. Now, here's the thing about Jerry Bain. Yeah, he's on record claiming that Kennedy said this, but said it back in 1961 in Seattle. In Seattle, I found the photos of Seattle motorcade. There's no grab handles. They were using a rented Lincoln limbo. So even if they wanted to ride the back of the car, they couldn't. There's no grab handles. The other time was Mexico. Something's wrong, Jerry. They didn't ride on the back of the car, but they were all over the car many times, all around the car, running and jogging with the limo. Oh, there was no grab handles on that too. It was a rented car as well. But again, even if someone wanted to say there's any truth to those prior trips, was there a prior precedent? I would say no, because I got the motorcade footage. They didn't have the grab handles to ride the car. And in Mexico, they were all around the car. And the thing about Tampa, again, it's only came out because years later, now talking to Bain and Boring and them adamantly denying there's any truth is Boring multiple times because Jerry Bain died 6 months later of cancer. Floyd Boring was still alive for quite a few years after, so I was able to re-interview him and reiterate stuff. So was the ARB, by the way. Well, when the motorcade films and photos came out of Tampa, I started saying, well, where was the opportunity to be ordered off there? They're everywhere. They're on the back of the car like crazy on this trip. So where were they at? And again, when I talked to Russell Groover, the Tampa police officer, he said they only did ride on the back of the car when we were heading back to MacDill when the public motorcade was over. They were going at a fast clip. So I'm like, did they use this as a cover story after the fact? Because who's going to know? Who's going to prove it? From a legal standpoint, they weren't on the back of the car at the last leg of the 28 miles. And Kennedy's dead, so they can't cross-examine him to see if it's true. Who's going to get these films and photos? This is before Woodward Bernstein, before the internet, before people were digging in photo and film archives. Anyway, it took a nerd like me decades later to find the stuff. So it sounds legit. Hey, the president didn't want them there. And that was what they used for a long time. But I think what happened with Bain and Boring and some of these other agents, they forgot the cover story from 1964. And when they're talking to me in the 90s and whatnot, the truth's coming out. And there's, I don't know, like Floyd Boring was the same way. Oh, there's no truth to that. In fact, he went even further, Matt, as you probably know from the first book. He denied the whole Manchester thing. He said, there's no, the Ivy League charges. That's not true. That's not true. I said, did you even speak to Manchester? He says, no, I already knew he didn't speak to Manchester because Manchester doesn't. The interesting thing about Manchester is he doesn't even source an interview with Floyd Boring, but he quotes him. But he did interview Emory Roberts and Gerald Blaine at Kennedy Detail fame. Emory Roberts died in 1973, as you know, is one of my suspects. Gerald Blaine denied ever speaking to William Manchester. Why did the further digging? Manchester died sometime in the 90s, maybe early millennium. I spoke to him in 1993. Manchester wouldn't cooperate. Well, Wesleyan University has all his materials, some of which was released by the ARB, but quite a few others are not going to be released to the year 2060. Some obscene numbers like that. Gerald Blaine's interview is missing. It's missing. So we have Gerald Blaine on video. I have a bootleg of it on my channel where he's sitting next to Clint Hill and says, oh, I never spoke to William Manchester. In 2005, Gerald Blaine admitted he was interviewed by Manchester. Now he's denying it for the record with Clint Hill sitting next to him, and his transcript is missing from Wesleyan University. And you might say, Vince, what does this all mean? I'm confused. What it means is he realizes, I know he was the source, not Floyd Boring, for planting this Ivy League charlatan mythology in Tampa, which was made in effect for Dallas for the agents not being there. So now he doesn't want to admit that he's the source, because now it's going to look pretty sinister. Because wait a minute, Floyd Bourne wasn't even interviewed for this book in the back. Anybody could check their death or present. Go there. It's an alphabetical war. There's no Floyd Bourne, but there is a Gerald Blaine interview from 1965. In 2005, Gerald Blaine admitted he was interviewed. Now he said, oh, I was never interviewed by Manchester. Never spoke to any author of a book. Because he realizes, and that's why in his book, The Kennedy Detail, and I'm going to say it, I'll take full responsibility for it. He made up a November 25th, 1963 meeting on the day of Kennedy's funeral. Tell me another one. All the agents got together and said, look, we can't say the President Kennedy didn't want us there. We can't make it look like in any way he's to blame. But that's what your book does, Jerry. That's what everybody takes away from it. It's a mission accomplished to counter me. In fact, I'm on page 359 to 360 of Kennedy Detail. He's a name he made for legal reasons. He says a self-described Secret Service expert and denigrates me and some other things I won't get into. But yeah, is it crazy? This little old me, I ruffled feathers and thought me on C-SPAN and all this stuff. It's all because, bottom line, is they realize, Matt, Oswald or no Oswald, conspiracy, no conspiracy. This assassination should have been prevented. That's not even rose-colored glasses. It should have been prevented.
Okay, Army intelligence. All right, so we got George Lumpkin. He's a deputy police chief, and he is in the Army Reserve and Army intelligence, and his instructor or advisor is Lieutenant Colonel George Whitmire. Lumpkin.
Oh, Whitmire and Lumpkin. Yeah, but you were right about Whitmire. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and then Whitmire was invited by Lumpkin to join the motorcade in the pilot car. And then we also have Winston Lawson, the advance man. He was Army intelligence before he joined the Secret Service. Of course, you have James Powell. There's a guy named Edward Croyle, who's military intelligence, who's there as well. James Powell is on site. He ends up going inside of the school book depository. So my question is, do you think there's anything to this Army intelligence angle, or do you think this is just merely a coincidence?
I definitely think there's something to it. Definitely. Winston Lawson even admitted they're not part of the scheduled motorcade. Whitmire wasn't. Whitmire's son, who has the same name, George Whitmire Jr., because George Whitmire died in 1978. I spoke to his son. Well, I shouldn't say spoke to my correspondent, would be more accurate. And he said, yeah, my father was the last second participant. He was there via Mr. Lumpkin. I'm like, oh, interesting. All this weird background military intelligence. They get out in front of the depository. You know, James Powell's officially, there's no military intelligence group in Dealey Plaza. Yet James Powell's there and he takes a photo of the book depository, gets trapped behind the book depository. It's very bizarre, certainly leads towards suspicion. And again, and we look at Winston Lawson's background. Winston Lawson did time in military intelligence, counterintelligence as well. And what's really interesting, Richard Case Nagel served at Fort Hollerberg around the same time in the 50s, so did Winston Lawson. And so did another agent, by the way, Lewis Sims, who was part of infamously the Watergate tapes thing. And he was also in the office when Abraham Bolden was there in Chicago. So certainly leads towards suspicion. Now, at this late date, decades later, so many people dead and you can't get them under oath, subpoena power, or handicap of, you know, a lot of smoke, there's some fire. I understand this. But yeah, do I think it's suspicious? I'd certainly do. And just because, again, I don't know anything about military intelligence, which is interesting, thanks to the ARB releases of the late 90s. San Antonio, there was a military intelligence group. It's like 20 to 40, I think it's 40, but let's just say 20 extra men were used to guard the motorcade. And obviously, the official story is they were told to stand down. The people that don't like Fletcher Prodty say, oh, he was making it up. There's no truth to that. But yet it turns out the military often did augment motorcades. That's 100% the truth. But you give me some of the foreign motorcades. They're obviously military men. Actually, just go to Tampa. They're wearing their MP badges. They're there. You know, they're armbands, I should say. And they're there. And again, it came out in the late 1990s for the ones that weren't shredded. As we know, in January 1995, after they were told by the Assassination Record Review Board, do not shred anything, the FBI didn't, the CIA didn't, the NSA didn't, the Secret Service destroyed motorcade records of a lot of President Kennedy's motorcades in the fall of 63. Only the Tampa trip survived, ironically, and that's damning to the Secret Service because multi-story building rooftops were guarded. So
let's go to that. That's the next thing I have on my list of questions to ask you. Destruction of Secret Service files. So Secret Service destroyed 4 of 6 boxes of files about fall 1963 trips. Mm-hmm. Now, here's a question I have. This is kind of a rebuttal, but it's actually It's not from a an anonymous listener. This is from Fred Litwin.
And, oh, boy. Yeah.
He didn't send it to me. This is just what he says. So I wanted to get you to address what his argument is. Fred argues that the HSCA looked at the same reports and they found nothing interesting. And so the destruction of the documents is not really a big deal. And then Fred said that he actually found the documents. So my question for you is, yeah, is it true that Litwin actually did indeed find the same documents that were supposed to
be? One. I'll give him credit. I mean, I'm saying this, Matt, you're not. I'll give the devil his due. Sorry. He did find one document, by chance. This still doesn't. This is like the Martha Stride document that Barry Ernst found. It's great, but it doesn't get the government off the hook. It was buried in documents. All right, buried documents for decades. I'll give Fred credit. He did find one part of the Chicago trip. I think it's the preliminary survey report, not the post survey report, the final survey report of the Chicago trip that was canceled November 2nd. He did find that. He didn't find any of the other ones were shredded. And even hypothetically speaking, if he found the other ones, well, they were destroyed by the Secret Service. Okay, a fluke of fate that there was other copies, thank God, but that doesn't get them off the hook. So to answer your question, he found 1% of what was shredded, and the 1% had nothing to do with taking them off the hook. They were told, don't shred them. There was going to be congressional hearings. Doug Horn was really mad about this, and so were the other members. Some of the members were adamantly believed Oswald Act alone wanted to have congressional hearings. And Ralph Basham, who later became Secret Service director, was part of this whole team going back and forth, apologizing. The ARB whipped out and just didn't want to hurt them, their chances with the Secret Service anymore and getting documents. So they let them slide out of the final report, that paragraph. And the thing that's brutal about it, they didn't just shred stuff from 61, 62, or early 63, fall of 63. And again, in films and photos and testimony, you know, I should say testimony, interviews I've had, it's very damning to the Secret Service, because again, you see agents on the back of the car, you see many motorcycles, you see multi-story building rooftops guarded, and those other, I'm very confident those shredded documents were shredded for a reason, because they would have showed a pattern. Well, why was he voted like this in Dallas? Look at the building rooftops and agents on the back of the car. Look at the motorcycle allotments. Look at the flatbed truck in front of Kennedy, or at least close by, because like in the Chicago trip report that Fred found, he found just the preliminary, not the post one, is usually more detailed. It talks about the press is all very close to Kennedy. Like they're all, the press and photographers are all close to Kennedy behind and before. In fact, there's a Chicago police squad car was behind the Secret Service FOB car. So you had all that. Oh, PRS found threats as well, and like in Dallas. So even what he did find is valuable in that respect too. But yeah, the Secret Service destroying it again. Like John Thunheim and other people of the IRB have said, we didn't get this from the CIA, the FBI, the NSA. Only the Secret Service destroyed records. We were livid. And Jack Thunheim's been a very vocal critic of the Secret Service. Their protection was horrible for Kennedy and Dallas. And again, they destroyed those for a reason. I am very confident if copies of those will be found, we're going to find even more corroboration. The one that did slip out, I don't know if it was a mistake, Tampa survived. You might think they should have destroyed that, Matt. It's just about the multi-story building rooftops,
yeah,
all guarded. And as we know from the films and photos, agents were on the back of the car for the majority of the trip. Military aid guard from McKee was riding a limousine. From the films and photos, we can see they're going at a fast rate of speed. There's a whole bunch of motorcycles all around the car in a wedge diamond formation. It just was beautiful security, especially for the time, too.
So bottom line, Secret Service destroyed these documents. Yes, there is a document from the HSCA that overlaps with the documents that were destroyed and is among the documents that were later destroyed.
1%.
However, we do not have the vast majority of the documents that were in those files, and they, in fact, have been destroyed for history, and we do not have them. Is that right?
Yes, Matt. And 100% correct, Matt. I was to add one little thing. I have no confidence whatsoever that the High Select Committee in the late 70s would have looked at those documents before they were shredded and found anything of value, because they just wouldn't have appreciated things, to be honest with you. So even if they would have looked at them, there's no evidence they did look at those specific ones. The Secret Service had them. We don't know for a fact the High Select Committee did. I have no confidence they would have said, hey, why are we building rooftops guard here and they weren't here? If you read the High Select Committee report, in a lot of respects, it reads like the Warren Commission. They wanted to tag it on Oswald. The only difference was they said that, the acoustical tapes, I guess Oswald had a friend who missed on the Knoll. Other than that, let's get a life. It was Oswald. Just he had some friend on the Knoll that missed. Here's another thing, too. In 1978, a vast majority of the Kennedy detail were active guarding Carter, guarding Nelson Rockefeller, former presidents. They were at Secret Service headquarters, et cetera, et cetera. To say they won't want to ruffle feathers is put it mildly. We're only talking 15 years later. So I don't even think even if they would have, they would have had the courage to say, hey, these guys are current now. We can't do this. So,
yeah.
Here you go.
The presidential ambulance that was in Dealey Plaza and was supposed to be around if something went wrong with the president, you know, medically, that was used to take some guy who had a seizure to
Jerry Belknap. Belknap.
I'd read that. I'd never heard that anywhere before. It struck me as strange that Dealey Plaza is where they had the ambulance station in the first place. And then the second thing is, so, I mean, do you think that guy is somehow involved to get the ambulance out of there? Or do you think that's just a coincidence?
Well, depending on my mood, I either say coincidence or sinister. But here's the thing. It kind of makes me think, lean towards more sinister, Matt. When I interviewed Aubrey Reich on, of all dates, November 22nd, 1997 in Dallas, he said that they were getting many false alarm calls to Dallas in the weeks before the assassination. So what? The ambulance was getting false alarm calls to Dealey Plaza before Dallas. And then on the day of assassination, an epileptic seizure guy gets picked up. It's famously depicted in the JFK movie. And he gets to park in the hospital and he looks around and no one's treating him and he leaves. In 1986, for the third decade print journal, somebody interviewed him. I think they interviewed him. And it was basically conveyed that Jerry in and of itself wasn't suspicious per se, but it was timed. Like, you can actually see this in the Hughes film when you can see the book depository window in the background. Some people try to freeze frame it so you can see movement. And down below is a flashing light of the ambulance. I will say this. I will concede we're never going to know for sure, but I will say I'm leaning more towards it being suspicious based on Aubrey Reich saying in the short weeks before the assassination, his ambulance was called on false alarms to Dealey Plaza. That seems like a dry run or something's going on, or they were creating a diversion for other people to move in or something.
Yeah.
Of all places, it wasn't Main Street. It wasn't some like Mockingbird Lane earlier in the motorcade. It was Dealey Plaza. It's another one of those things, Matt. It just makes you go, what? Yeah.
Your child has so much potential, but your local schools may not be right for them. Check out K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited tuition-free online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
This weekend, only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.
All right, so we're getting close to wrapping up here. I want to quickly touch on Abraham Bolden. Your most recent book, it's called, what's it called? The Chicago Plot? And it's got a specific name. There it is.
Chicago Plot. The Plot Killer in Chicago. And the other, yes. Yeah, Tracy Conspiracy. You got.
There we go. Okay, good. I had always, as I had been when I was more of a casual observer of this stuff before I got into throwing 25 hours a week at it. I'd always thought Abraham Bolden was, that there was a lot of documentary evidence for that. But it turns out we really just have Bolden's testimony. And then we have all the stuff around the weird things that happened to him, how he got arrested. He's later proven to have been, his arrest is proven to be he was set up, and Spagnola, the guy who testified against him, admitted that he was told to do that by the prosecutor. So there are reasons to believe Bolden. And in terms of him as a person, he comes across as extremely credible.
Yes.
And so I land on believing Abraham Bolden, that there was this four-person team. But I get there less certain of it and less confident of it than I was before, in terms of like a percentage of certainty, just because there's no other documentary evidence or witnesses really.
Yeah, I don't agree with that, actually.
Okay, good. So what would you say to someone who makes that argument? What would you say to, support the credibility of the Bolden story, since there's not a ton of documentary evidence there?
Sure. And I would concede from the outset that I concede my latest book on the Chicago plot is flawed. It's not perfect. It's decades later. It's amateur me doing the best I can. There's a lot of people that are passed away. A lot of documents have never been released. Documents that we were just talking about were shredded on the Chicago trip. Notwithstanding the ones that Fred found. But the bottom line is there is one huge, huge piece of evidence that, in my opinion, totally corroborates Abraham Bolden is. Remember I mentioned earlier about Thomas Shipman? I talked about that George McNally, head of the White House Communication Agency, former Secret Service agent, who wrote a book called A Million Miles of President. He talks about Thomas Shipman in his book. Well, in that very same book, again, he died in 1970. His widow released it in 1982. It didn't get any fanfare. It was a very obscure book. Well, in that same book, he talks about the March 1963 trip to Chicago, the trip they took before the canceled one, November 2nd. In that, he says that the police got word of Puerto Rican snipers. Now, it'd be bad if it was sniper anyway, but snipers plural. He said helicopters searched the roofs of buildings and no snipers were found. The bottom line is Puerto Rican snipers, plural, were found to be a mortal threat to the president in March of 63, the trip before the trip everybody thinks about in Chicago in 63. It sounds a heck of a lot like they failed once and they were trying to succeed a second time. Again, this is a guy, the former Secret Service agent, head of WICA. I was talking about all these trips, matter-of-factly, in order. It goes from FDR, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy. It's a lot of dry reading, no index, and out of nowhere. I've made great play about this for years, and I think it's a smoking gun in Abraham Bolden's direction because it's a prior trip. It's not like Louisville. It'd be important if it was any trip. But of all places, it's Chicago. The police got word of Puerto Rican snipers. Helicopters being used, and sometimes, yes, they were used as security on trips too. That's another matter in and of itself. Helicopters were actually used before Dallas. Wow. Mm-hmm. And yet, it just makes you think that the records that were released, thanks to Fred on the Chicago trip. Maurice Marno, the head of the Chicago office, and that's how I start my new book. He told me in 1993, he believed there was a conspiracy to kill Kennedy. He didn't want to get into any details other than the fact that my own role in the investigation, the House Select Committee interviewed me, and I found the House Select Committee a lot more valid than the Warren Commission when the ballistics and the details came back. And I said, well, sir, can you tell me a little more? And he said, I'd rather not. But the bottom line is the head of the Chicago office, Bolden's boss, who was on both trips, by the way, is saying he believed there was a conspiracy. So between what Bolden's boss was no fan of Bolden, Maurice Martin said, Abraham Bolden was a stain on the agency. I'd rather not talk about him. So he was no fan. So for his boss to say that he believed there was a conspiracy and tied in with what George McNally said about the prior trip, I would say that's pretty amazing. And then when you factor in what James Douglas reports to JFK and the Speakable, some of his interviews with Thomas Arthur Valley's sister, and also with, Edwin Black reported back in 1975. I know some people say, oh, Vincent, Edwin Black, well, that's just Abraham Bolden. It wasn't just Abraham Bolden. People don't understand this. There's actually, there's actually more now that I think about it. There's actually more. Thomas Cole was an FBI agent that briefly spoke to Edwin Black. And in that, he goes, look, some people were picked up. Talk to the Secret Service. I don't want to talk about this. Some people, plural. It would be bad enough if he said a person was picked up. Some people, plural, were picked up on November 2nd. So this is an FBI agent, but people gloss on that because they go, oh, that Edwin Black article was all Bolden. It wasn't. It was also Sherman Skolnick, who was an investigator in the Chicago area. It was also a source for Edwin Black. But more importantly, there's a gaggle of Chicago police he interviewed. And what they say is mostly about Valley. I'll concede that. And Thomas Arthur Valley is valuable because Thomas Arthur Valley, when he was found in 1975, the first words out of his mouth were, oh, yeah, Soldier Field, the plot to kill Kennedy in Chicago. And he talked about training into capture Cubans, and he was part of a CIA mission. But Thomas Cole, an FBI agent at the time, says, get the rest from the Secret Service. Some people were picked up. If there's nothing to any of this, Thomas Cole would have said no comment or there's nothing to this at all. You're barking up the wrong tree. But he said some people were picked up. I'd say that's three or four pretty big strains that I, you know, make great play of in my book, you know, tying everything together. But basically, this is basically everything we know from Bolden, everything we know from prior sources. And also, one more, too, I'm not leaving out probably the biggest thing of all, is the first chapter of the book is an agent with a pretty weird name, Nemo Ciocina. Nemo Ciocina was a fellow office worker in Chicago office like Abraham Bolden, who, by the way, is named in the new Chicago Files found by Fred Litwin. He was adamant there was a conspiracy to kill Kennedy in Chicago as well. Another thing we'll say is for your listeners that, you know, Abraham Bolden was pardoned by President Biden a couple years ago, which was amazing in and of itself. And Abraham Bolden's always adamant. I always stick with Abraham Bolden, too, because I say this, too. Abraham Bolden won commendations for counterfeiting investigations. He was the first African-American agent of the Pinkerton Detective Agency. He was a former state trooper and a decorated member of the Chicago office who served from Eisenhower to LBJ, briefly on the White House detail under Kennedy. But he protected Kennedy when Kennedy came to Chicago in 61, 62, and 63. He's in those documents, November 2nd, as well as the March 63. Abraham Bolden was part of protecting Kennedy during his prior trips, too. I don't believe for a second Abraham Bolden did that. That's, first of all, another thing, that's a white-collar crime. That's the kind of thing you get pretty lose your job. You get, you know, like house arrest, parole, and whatnot. You get thrown in, like, mass murderers, get in a federal penitentiary for that. That is nothing. And he had a wife and kids. There's no way he's going to – and really what really does it for me, it wasn't just any old criminal. It's a guy that Abraham Bolden was trying to send up the river, send to prison. And the same gentleman told the judge that I was, you know, suborned perjury in the Bolden matter. But the Edward Hanahan, the district attorney, all of them wanted to railroad a black man. This is 1964, it came on. They wanted Bolden to go away, and they didn't like him casting aspersions on the Secret Service. He talks about laxity and drinking while in detail. They didn't want any of this. So they wanted to put him away. So,
anyway. All right, last question.
Sure.
In your book, in Survivor's Guilt, you a few times you mentioned this idea of a security test, like the big picture, sort of the theory of what's happening. Could you just kind of unpack how you got to that idea, what support there is for it, and then maybe how that dovetails into your vision of kind of what happened in Dealey Plaza overall, like with the big picture?
Yes. The whole security stripping thing, I'll admit, it's speculative. Can't prove it. Okay. But the seeds of it were threefold. What it was, I know it's Farewell America. The book's a little controversial, but it talks about a fascinating idea about a security stripping test, so to speak. Was this a fake attack on Kennedy that was corrupted by people with a more sinister idea? Was Oswald or others roped into this idea that there was going to be a fake test of the president's security, a fake assassination? Again, I understand it's appointment in Dallas, but the author of that also laid claim the whole idea that this could have been a fake assassination. I kind of ran with that when George Michael Evick, a pretty respected author, came the idea of a third alternative to me back in 1991 in Fredonia, the conference I mentioned earlier. Says, Vince, not everything's innocent or guilt. Could be a third alternative here. Could these men have been convinced there's going to be some test on the president's security and or fake assassination? Could that be the reason why things look sinister and they really aren't? Could it be that Oswald and other people were told this was going to be a test of the president's security and the agents themselves could have been a test of president's security? And then, oh my God, the president's really killed. And there was a cover up after the fact because they purposely stood down. People were purposely put in places to make it look sinister when they really weren't there to kill him, but other nefarious organizations. So I always try to make in the book that was separate. You can tell, like, it's heavily documented. It's based on interviews, corroborated evidence from documents, this, that, and the other. But at the end, I'll always say, like, I forget how I phrase it. At the end of every agent, it's those roll call participants. We'll talk about every agent. And I basically tell their role in this affair. And I give them an out. So what I'm trying to show is that third alternative. That even though Floyd Boring, Emory Roberts, Bill Greer, and some of the agents look sinister, could it be that there was possibly a test of the president's security, and to add insult to injury, it was corrupted by those that wanted to kill Kennedy? In other words, these agents were told, look, there was the Bay of Pigs, and there's a Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy shutting down the camps, whatnot. We're going to have a test of the president's security. I mean, it's even wake JFK up to doing something about Cuba, whatnot. or for whatever other reason. And so the angel told, okay, this is no big deal. We're just going to be told not to do anything, to stand there for a few seconds. Yeah. And then, my God, he's killed under their watch, and they didn't guard building rooftops to do the things they're supposed to. So they started to panic and blame Kennedy for the security. He's dead. They can't, you know, defend himself. And at the same time, could it be that, and this is controversial, it's in my last book, Honest Answers, could it be that Oswald's rifle is guilty of sin as being one of the rifles involved in killing Kennedy or attempting to kill Kennedy, but Oswald himself didn't fire it? The rifle somehow, some way was put into the building, because the rifle wouldn't work if it was taken apart and put together. You have to sight it in, it won't work properly. Could it have been put in there and someone else? And maybe even, this really even complicates things, could Oswald even known that his rifle was going to be used? It'd be tantamount to see those old 70s police stories where somebody uses the getup car and they kill somebody. Some of you loan your getaway car, now you're being railroaded for murder because it was your car. But you didn't drive it, you weren't there. Could it have been the same thing with the rifle? So that's a long-winded way, Matt, of saying the security stripping test was my way of giving them an out. So when people read the book on, boy, Vince thinks all these agents are sinister. Come on, pal. When you get to the bottom line of every agent, you say, oh, okay, Vince is saying he doesn't think this agent's sinister. Or Vince thinks this guy's merely following orders and this, that, and the other. That was a way of doing that. Now, in 2025, am I as sure as I was in 2013 there was a security stripping test? No, I'm a little bit less sure than I even was back then of the possibility. But it was a way of giving them an out. I think a lot of people have said, that's good you did that, Vince. It's good you don't see conspiracies in your soup and everything is sinister. It's my way of giving them an out. So, yeah.
So zooming out on your overall perspective, then, it sounds like you would say that, look, if there was something shady that happened and it was intentional and nefarious, then here's the ones to look at, your three, Greer, Emery Roberts, and Floyd Boring. But it's also true that really no matter what, the conspiracy plot would not have originated with those three. They just would have been people who were brought into it to do very specific things, if that's the case.
Exactly. You got it. They're not the originators of it. Means if they cross the line beyond gross negligence and something sinister, Christopher the Mill, for all three of those guys in particular, to a lesser extent, Four Souls, to a lesser extent, Elmer Moore, an agent we didn't speak about, who interviewed the Parkland Doctors, Texas School Depository people, you know, got Dr. Perry to say this wasn't a throat entrance wound and said Kennedy was a traitor and this, that, and the other. It gives them an out that maybe they were just following orders from above, and or there was supposedly this fictitious test of the present security that was compromised and made them shut the heck up because they compromised him and he wasn't just shot with blanks. He was murdered and they're directly responsible. So now Kennedy's dead. They created this mythology. They ordered them off the car, had a rendezvous with death. Oh, he just didn't want any protection whatsoever. Get them off the trail. So.
Sure. Well, hey, Vince, you got a lot of books that I highly recommend that everybody check out your books. Can you tell us real quick the books you have on the JFK assassination, the title?
Yeah, real quick. First one, Survivor's Guilt, the Secret Service, and the Failure to Protect President Kennedy. Second one is JFK from Parkland to Bethesda. This is on the medical evidence. This is categorized because everybody who said anything about the wounds, whatnot, from Parkland, Bethesda, and all points in between. The Not-So-Secret Service, this covers from FDR to Reagan. Who's Who in the Secret Service, this covers every agent, good, bad, and ugly. This is the good and bad ugly of the Secret Service is what this is. This is everybody from 1865 to up. This book is the book on the assassination itself. In other words, okay, enough about the Secret Service and even the medical evidence, Vince, although they're included. What do you think about the assassination? What happened? What didn't happen? What's your opinion? Because people ask me for years, Vince, you should write a book just on the assassination. This is what this is. And I was going to say finally, but it's not finally. My sixth book, The Plot to Kill President Kennedy in Chicago, a visual investigation. There's also a chapter about prior threats, a lot of detailed stuff about prior threats as well, and a detailed chapter about building rooftops and prior security too. So it's not just the Chicago plot. Some people got lost in the shuffle, like, this is just about the Chicago plot, but I make pains to say that. I have a final book coming out this spring. It's called President Kennedy Should Have Survived Dallas, Secret Service and the JFK assassination. And what that is my first book was 500 pages. This one is half that. It's about 250 pages, and it's basically through the lens of Hill and Blaine's and Lannis's book, through the lens of their book, what I think did and did not happen, but it's using their lens so you see the real story. Not just Vince Palmer's claiming this and the other. You see through what they said, and you see the real story. And so that's what that is. So.
Well, hey, thanks, Vince. We appreciate you being so generous with your time today. I mean, yeah, it's like I said, it's just great to be able to talk to you and get all this information.
Same here, Matt. Appreciate it, man. Thanks.
Appreciate all the work you've put into this over the years. Really, really moving the ball forward. Because for someone like me, my thing is I'm not an expert on any topic, and I just try to find the experts, and I try to find what are the counter arguments to what the experts say. And that's kind of the game I'm playing. So the fact that all this work's already been done, it's amazing for me coming to the game so late. So,
oh, that's great. Yeah. I appreciate your input, man. I appreciate your YouTube channel, all you're doing too. So that's great, man.
You want the best for your child. K-12 can help them gain the skills they need to reach their full potential while giving you the support you need to get them there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Their state-certified teachers make online learning interactive and engaging, allowing your child to learn at their pace from the safety of home. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
This weekend, only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.